Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, we're back. It feels like it's been forever, but it's really only been 7 days since the last toy department, Matt Kolsky.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, shoot. You distracted me with your question. I had a whole plan of how I was what my first noises on this podcast were going to be.
Okay, do tell.
Okay, ready? Owie, owie, oh. That's all I got.
I'm confused.
Well, it's Jungle Love.
I guess it
is. I really want to know
you. Yeah, see, now if you throw that in, I would have been right there with you.
Yeah, okay.
You know, it's funny because I'm doing this podcast with a man holding a mirror up in front of me as we speak, just so I can make sure things are tight.
I hope you have a lacy handkerchief to pat your brow if you get sweaty at all.
That is one of those things about living in Minnesota is that you automatically develop an attachment to things Prince and Prince related. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah.
Like you just feel like they're yours. And so I now, you know, have a connection to the time that feels weird and personal, even though I haven't spent a lot of time listening to the time, but I was like legitimately psyched to see them up there on the Grammy stage.
Yeah, me too, actually. You know, and I don't even live in Minnesota. Never have.
Yeah, that was one of the cooler moments, I think. Where did you stand on Bruno Mars in his performance in the Prince tribute?
I don't think there's anything to complain about. You know, first of all, I didn't know he played the guitar. And, you know, nobody's Prince, but Bruno Mars acquitted himself well, I thought, and definitely played a Prince-y guitar solo and looked the part, and he can really sing. So, I mean, look, we're never going to confuse the two. Bruno Mars is no Prince, but I thought it was a good tribute.
Yeah, I think you kind of hit on it right there. And it was somebody pointed this out to me. It was like, yes, like I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the Bruno Mars thing. I enjoy all Bruno Mars' things. I think he, like,
yeah,
of all the guys working in pop music, he's as insanely talented as any of them. And just, I really, you know, we've talked about Bruno on the show before.
Mm-hmm.
But part of the whole thing is like, wow, it took a lot of stick to do that, to get out there and wear the Prince get up and,
yep,
and play a guitar solo. But like, that's the coolness of it, is that it just took balls.
Yeah.
It also goes hand in hand with, well, he's not Prince. And
right,
like, you know, it's the Grammys and you've got, you know, you got some guitar heavyweights in there. Like, why isn't Gary Clark Jr. out there doing that solo? You know what I mean?
Honestly, you know, look, there's no question in my mind Gary Clark Jr. is a better guitarist than Bruno Mars, but could he have played a princier guitar solo?
Yeah.
Could he have done? I don't know.
Yeah,
I really didn't have a problem with it.
I don't see him wearing the outfit, and maybe that
certainly
maybe
wasn't going to wear the outfit. And I would rather see Gary Clark Jr. do what Gary Clark Jr. does, which is exactly what happened when he did his little blues set in the middle of the audience.
Yeah, I think Gary Clark Jr., not to get too far into the Gary Clark Jr. hole that interests about five people, but that guy, I think he's a really versatile guitarist. I think that's kind of part of his strength, is that guy's fluent in, you know, the blues is the main sort of area that he works, but he can go wherever he wants with that thing, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, again, I'm not – he could have done exactly what Bruno Mars did. I'm just saying I had no – while, again, he is clearly not Prince. Nobody is. I really felt like it was a fitting tribute, and I felt like, you know, what was incredible about Prince is that he was, on one hand, this outsized pop presence, this gender-bending – you know, incredible funk, R&B, pop artist.
You got to throw rock in there too, man. I think that's like part of it was that this guy.
Yeah,
like
no, you're legitimately right. All that stuff. He's combining genres. He's doing all these things, and he's doing it all himself. And so to have a guy who, you know, probably is the closest thing we've got going right now, do an impression essentially. Look, it's not going to be as good as the original, but I think it's a fitting tribute.
Yeah, it was one of the better things that. You know, in terms of execution on the Grammy night.
Although I gotta say, I was pleasantly surprised by the Grammy night as a whole. Once I got through the country garbage in the first half of it, I thought the second half of the show was really good. I Adele is an incredible talent, and the stuff she said when she won Record or Album of the Year, I thought was touching and appropriate. Most of the collaborative performances, I really liked Gaga and Metallica, even though James Hetfield's mic didn't work for the first verse and a half. I thought the musical performances this year, and it may have to do with the fact that, you know, we lost so many musical icons, so they were paying tribute to people whose music I love, but I thought the musical performances in general were really engaging.
Can I offer a counterpoint to that?
Of course.
The Bee Gees tribute and Lucas Graham, and I'm done.
Yeah, well, like I said, I skipped through the country garbage for the most part. Okay. The Bee Gees tribute, I actually thought it was. I mean, I have no personal feelings that would require a tribute to the Bee Gees, but I didn't think it was poorly executed.
Ooh, yeah, I thought it was horrendous. Maybe I have more respect for the Bee Gees.
I think you probably do.
than you do? I don't know.
The Bee Gees, but, you know what my favorite Bee Gees moment is? Limp. My favorite Bee Gees moment is the scene in Swingers where the insanely old people are playing a broken version of Staying Alive in the dive bar in Los Angeles. That's where I'm at with the Bee Gees.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, look, am I listening to Bee Gees records? No, but I have an appreciation for their place in pop history. And, okay. You know, and the Bee Gees.
More or less appreciation than you have for ABBA.
More.
Exactly.
More. I'd say more.
You had to think about it.
For you, I think that was a put down. Like, I think I have a lot more appreciation for ABBA than you do as well.
No, I'm sure you do, but, they've occupied the same space of spiritually dead pop music.
I don't find either of those spiritually dead, to be honest.
All right. Fair enough.
To me, the Bee Gees are like the Metallica of what they do. Oh, you know stop. What I mean?
That's sure, but what they do is trivial and annoying.
So you're writing off all of disco as trivial and annoying.
At large as trivial and annoying. Sure, there are maybe like 15 good disco songs, and the Bee Gees wrote three of them. So congratulations, but like,
oh, they wrote a lot more than three good songs. I don't care. And disco's more than three good songs.
I said 15. I gave disco 15. You know, there's some.
Whatever. I'm not here to defend disco.
Okay, good.
Let's look at it. You know, from a 30,000 foot view.
Yeah.
Like, what do you think these Grammy Awards were trying to say?
Boy, that's a good question.
Or
I don't think are they trying to say anything?
You know, what does it say about the state of music today? Maybe is a more precise version of that question.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think it's the state of music is the state of entertainment in general, which is that the world we live in has given us so many options that like our culture no longer has these monolithic things. And look, I mean, this is not an original idea, and the use of the word monolith is probably over the top at this point in our culture, but I think it's because people are really trying to deal with this fact that like there is no – even pop music, no one on pop radio has the impact that even Britney Spears had 20 years ago or whenever it was that she came out, and that is largely because the attention is split, and we're never going back to a place where – you know, one artist captures the imagination and attention of the entire nation in the way they did in the 80s and 90s. I don't think that's ever happening again. So
agreed. Anyone who does that now, it can do it because they were a product of that time.
Exactly. You know, and you see that with the way these people are honored, like the big numbers. Like, I don't know any Chainsmokers or 21 Pilots songs, you know? And I didn't really know that Lucas Graham song that he sang
like 3 weeks ago.
No, I know. I know the song we listened to for the podcast, yeah. but I don't like have a favorite Chainsmokers song. I don't have a favorite 21 Pilots song. I couldn't name a 21 Pilots song for you. I couldn't name a Lucas Graham song. I didn't hate that song. I think it's actually a pretty good song.
No,
but
the song itself obnoxious. Is really good. That performance was not.
Yes, agreed. So yeah. So like it's not to say music is bad, but people in the world have been given the ability via technology to select their personal preferences much more specifically, and that is naturally leading to less universally known or popular things. And I think not only the Grammys, but the Emmys and the Oscars have to deal with the same thing.
Yeah, I think it happens in that order. But yeah, the Emmys are next on this, you know, where it's going to just be too hard to capture all of what's happening in the medium in an award show, because it's just going to be too diffuse in terms of the things that people are watching, where you can't possibly honor everything. And that's the thing. And maybe this
I do think the Grammys has a built-in advantage over the Oscars and Emmys in that respect, just because they can do what they did last night, which is essentially just have a big music party and make the award presentation somewhat incidental.
Right. And that's, you know, that's kind of what I was going to say is like, you know, the Grammys have been on that tip for at least, you know, 5-7 years now.
Yes.
Like, the awards are inconsequential to the point where you could really envision a day where there actually aren't even any. You know what I mean? Where they're all given out prior to the broadcast.
Right, and they just kind of scroll them along the screen at some point.
Yeah, they can put them on the crawl, you know, like the ESPN bottom line or something.
Right.
The awards don't matter, and they're not a statement. And, like, I know that everyone was sort of looking like, well, Adele and Beyonce are nominated in all these categories, and which one the Grammy picks says a lot about what the Grammy – no, it doesn't say anything.
It's,
you know,
I agree.
Except maybe something about the collective taste of 2,000 people who voted in the process. You know what
well,
I mean?
Well, like, I do it. Think it's – if it says anything, it's that winning awards as a person of color – you just have to do a lot more. And that's not really – I don't think that's due to anything other than the people picking the awards mostly are not people of color and mostly are outdated in their taste.
Yeah, but see, I don't even think it's even that. It's like, look, I'm professionally in the music industry, right? Like this is my job. I do it every day. You know, my area of expertise – only extend so far. Like, yes, I can name many 21 Pilot songs, and you know, I can name multiple Lucas Graham songs. I'm probably one of 20 people on earth who can do that. But like, there are many areas of music that I literally know nothing about. And so, you know, when you have people voting on these things,
there's like, nobody in the recording industry who doesn't know Adele and Beyonce.
Right, but there are people who listen to one kind of music more than another kind of music and may have a – like music is so personal. You know what I mean?
But let's talk about – I understand your point and it's true. Your point is right overall. But let's just look at this situation. You have Adele, who is a tremendous talent, can sing the roof off of any building. And is also, as we saw on multiple occasions last night, seemingly a very real and somewhat delightful human being.
Yes.
All of which is true. And she made an album that is perfectly good. And Beyonce, who is probably America's greatest star in pop culture in general, made a completely personal, stepped completely out of her comfort zone, made a personal album that's thoughtful, that speaks directly to the culture, that has real implications about social issues, and is also musically tremendous. And Adele basically said this, there's simply no measure by which 25 deserved Album of the Year over Lemonade. Okay. There's no rubric.
Can I interject a couple of things into this?
Sure.
Like, first of all, one thing you left out in that comparison is that the Adele record had hits on it and Lemonade didn't. And that's a fact. We can talk about the daring of it, and I don't argue with any of that. We could talk about the quality of it. Yes, I think Lemonade was a better album. But the individual songs on Adele's record resonated with people in a way that the individual songs on Lemonade did not. And that matters. That matters for people when they're casting votes. And this second point, which I'll make.
Can I read you the description
that I think
of the
is more important? Let me just make this point and then you can say whatever you want. Also nominated in this category for Album of the Year was Justin Bieber's Purpose. So, like, let's not act like this is some total, like, this is some real measure of quality. It's a completely arbitrary award. So, like, there's no notion
of
justice.
Well, except that's not the case.
Like, it's ridiculous. None of it should have been taken seriously to begin with.
Okay, fine. We can agree. And that is factually true. And you're right. Ultimately, in the real world, the meaning of this is nothing, and it doesn't speak to the quality of Beyoncé's album. However, let me read to you the defined criteria from the Grammy Awards about what the Album of the Year is supposed to be awarded to. Okay? Quote, to honor artistic achievement, technical proficiency, and overall excellence without regard to album sales or chart position.
Okay.
So
– but you – it's not
– again, but it doesn't really matter.
Hit songs
is
not about
– they don't follow
– it's not about chart position. Like when I say a hit song, what I mean is like people – hit songs are what make people excited about records. And Beyonce, like, this is not a slag on Beyonce at all. Like, Beyonce,
it is a little.
Beyonce made her, like, Radiohead record. Radiohead's, like, my favorite band. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's avant-garde and it's out there and it's meant as an album statement that comes with a video and, like, all of these things that I think are great and daring and
should
be applauded.
And there are awards for hits. But there's an award called Record of the Year that Adele also won for her hit, Hello, which, by the way, is like her fifth or seventh best song. Yeah. Like it's just
I don't know about that. Hello's pretty great.
I like Hello, but there's five better songs on 21 alone.
And yes, 21 is a much better record than 25. Like
so, that's all, and so is Lemonade, and that's all I'm saying.
But
and I wish
I
that instead
like,
of
I just this notion of justice. And all right, look, here's the other thing, and this is the other rant that I've sort of been saving, and I'm gonna preface this by saying that I like Beyoncé a lot. I have a ton of respect for Beyoncé. I really enjoyed Lemonade. I've said so on this podcast when we talked about Coachella not recently. I said one of the things that I was most looking forward to was seeing Beyoncé. I've never seen Beyoncé.
Yeah, I'm out now, by the way. Now that if Beyoncé is out, I'm out.
Yeah, that hasn't been officially announced, but it's really hard to see how she's going to be playing at Coachella, right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. I'm not here to tear down Beyoncé, but at the same time, enough. Like anything that this woman does is breathlessly fawned over on social media with just the most over the top, exaggerated. Like we are not. It's to the point where I feel like, and I tweeted this actually when it happened, like that you can't say anything critical about Beyoncé. And the thing that struck me as she's doing that performance, which, you know, was visually incredibly powerful and interesting, and an interesting statement was like that the song was really not that fun to listen to.
It was a weird choice.
Because everybody's like, oh my God, Queen Bey, look at her. She's out there slaying. Can we just have 4 hours of Beyoncé? Oh my God, she's the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. Full body orgasm. Enough. Like, yes, she's a really, really talented pop star and a damn treasure. But, like, not everything she does. Like, the woman does not poop gold, okay? Like,
first of all, you can't prove that. Second of all, I agree with you. But I think you know that's not what I'm doing. I'm talking about the actual achievement of the album
and
the criteria upon which the Grammy is supposed to be handed out, and they did it wrong. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, of course. Like, you've been alive since what, it's 80s, early 80s?
Derek, if your position is, of course the Grammys did it wrong, then fine. Yes. I'm not saying I necessarily expected better, but I think if we're going to talk about the Grammys, it's fair to say that they gave the album of the year to the wrong person.
Sure. And you know what? You could say that literally about 85% of the Grammys in your lifetime. Just go back and look at the album of the year award. Like,
that is probably true.
The other thing I tweeted that night, it was Grammys gonna Grammy. Like, you know, like, yes, that's what they do. Like, it's not, you know, it's not the entire voting public. It's it's a certain body of the music industry. And it just is what it is. And music is really personal and it touches people in different ways. And you're never going to have a music award show. Never.
Okay, but see, that this really is why I'm going to continue this argument with you, is because do you really think it was a personal choice issue that gave it to Adele over Beyonce? Because I don't. I don't think it was a bunch of Grammy voters who were spoken to intimately by Adele's album.
What do you think it is?
That.
Like, for what do you think is the motivation for someone to vote for 25 over Lemonade, other than that they liked it better? Seriously, like, do you think it's abject racism? Because I'm going to go no on that. I really am.
I think it's latent racism.
I really think it is.
I really think it's, Beyonce made this. I think for Beyonce, Adele is a straightforward pop vocal album. It's a safe choice.
Yes,
I think that's what it's about.
She made a middle of the road record and people in the middle of the road selected it. End of story.
Okay.
Like, this is my problem. It's like, yes, did Beyonce make a better record than Adele? Yes. Yes, she did.
Yes. Well, okay, I think we're done.
Okay, great. But, like, it's not acting like this is some, as soon as the word justice enters the picture, I'm out.
Okay.
I have no intention of taking this to
the Supreme Court.
And I think that, like, you know, frankly, Adele getting up there and going, Beyonce, you should have won this.
Could have been a better result than Beyonce winning.
Yeah, it was a bigger moment. And by the way, this is now the third time this has happened to her in some major, hugely publicity way. Like, she's hers. Like, really, at the end of the night, are we supposed to weep for Beyonce and what she hasn't, like this woman is living the best life. You know what I mean?
But can I ask you, were you watching her face with the announcement of those last two awards?
I saw her face in the Adele acceptance speech, which she seemed genuinely touched.
Yes, she was clearly moved.
I did not see during the announcement, no.
Maybe it's me projecting, but I just feel like I watched her heartbreak a little bit twice with those last two awards.
I mean, at the end of the conversation,
it made me sad.
We're talking about someone who has been nominated for more Grammys than literally anyone in history, and I'm pretty sure is up there in terms of numbers of wins. So, like, yeah, she
does not need my sympathy.
She didn't get one more Grammy. You know what I mean? It's probably going to be a really tough night for her. You know, like, Jesus, that's like, come on. Sorry. All right, that's the end of that. That's the end of my Grammys thing.
Let's take a deep breath and move along.
Okay. You want to cover? You want to stay in the world of entertainment, or should we jump to sports?
Yeah, let's stay entertainment for now.
Can we talk about Legion?
Please.
So, we mentioned this as homework last week, I believe, but Legion airs FX on Thursday nights, which is a bummer for us because we taped the show on Wednesdays. And so it's a long time before we get to talk about it. I feel a little disconnected from it at this point.
Actually, it's worse because it's actually on Wednesday nights.
Oh, is it? It's a Wednesday night. You're right. Sorry. Yeah, sorry. So, you know, I live in a DVR world.
I hear you.
And so, yeah, so it's a really long time before we get to talk about it. But I am, you know me, I was a little bit weirded out, or trepidatious maybe would be a better word. about the show because I tend not to like shows about superheroes, and that's very clearly what this is. But you know, when I have the superhero things that, you know, that I enjoyed before I got the fatigue, tended to be things like the Christopher Nolan Batman movies. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like I just like good writing and filmmaking and yep. directing and, you know, and so I was the question for me coming into this, was, is the presence of Noah Hawley, you know, as a writer and director going to overshadow just the general, the superhero-ness of it? And I think I've pretty much given it away that, yeah, it's a resounding yes for me. Like, I'm all in. You know.
I mean, obviously, I didn't have the same obstacles to overcome in terms of like built-in bias against it, but I loved it.
Yeah,
I thought it was smart. I thought they did, you know, as pilots or first episodes go, I thought they did a great job of both setting the scene and actually starting the story. You know, because a lot of pilots, especially when you have a story like this that sort of inherently contains so much prologue,
right.
And a lot of times the pilot will just be prologue,
right.
And that was not this.
We know all the beats of the superhero origin story now because it's been told right. through so many heroes in so many different ways. And I felt like, you know, this managed to do that story, but in a way that felt really different and fresh. And I wonder, you know, the one thing I do wonder about is – you know, so much of this is going to be built on, you know, the unreliable narrator. And we saw, you know, in Mr. Robot, which I have a feeling this is a show this is going to kind of get compared to in a lot of ways over time, that there are some, that, you know, that can be a frustrating experience at times.
Yes.
You know, all of these feints about what's really happening and what isn't. And, you know, and I wonder how they are going to be able to weave through that and make it an interesting and surprising story without it being, you know, at times ultimately frustrating.
Right. Because I think we both had the same reaction to the second season of Mr. Robot when, spoiler alert, it turned out he was in jail almost the entire first half of the season. We were all like, okay, fine. But how about tell us a story that's really happening in the world of the show?
Right.
And Legion has that built in issue. But you know, I'll say this, based on the pilot and my experience with Fargo, which is my other, you know, touchstone for Noah Hawley, I have no doubt that it's going to be handled well.
Yeah. And visually, the show is just
– oh, it looks incredible.
So striking. I mean
– and it's got – you know, first of all, I was so thrilled to see Katie Azleton in an actual role, because really I've mostly only seen her on The League and you know, a handful of other goofy comedies.
Is it Azleton or Asselton?
I have no idea, actually.
I always thought it was Asselton because they refer to themselves as Duplasselton. She's married to Mark Duplass. So,
right. Yeah. That makes sense. But also, that's how you pronounce Duplass. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
let's call her Asselton just because you're probably right. And I really liked her in the sort of mom role. And I just really – I thought it was clever and funny and also interesting. Like it was a great pilot episode. I'm really excited about tonight.
Yeah, really strong cast. You know, and Rachel Keller.
Mm.
Oh, Rachel Kell.
Okay, calm down. Calm down. This is a family show.
Indeed. I'll shut up about Rachel Keller then. you know, I really – all of the elements are there, and it's exciting to see the first episode of something that you feel like really could turn into some – you know, already it was a great start, and you feel like it could really be – continue to be something great. And then, you know – I love the idea too that, you know, this is ostensibly in the Marvel universe, but it appears to be so far in its own corner of that, that, you know, for someone like me, who's a little bit weighed down by just the, you know, the mythology and fanboy rules and things like that. Like, I think it's just going to be completely disconnected from all of that.
Yeah, well, there is something with like when you watch the Netflix Marvel shows, and it's like, okay, now it's Luke Cage, and now it's Daredevil, and now it's Jessica Jones. It's like you're kind of just waiting for the other ones to show up. in, you know, when you're watching Luke Cage and it's like, all right, Daredevil's bound to show up at some point and we'll probably meet Jessica Jones again. And then you're watching Jessica Jones and it's like, all right, where's Daredevil? And oh, there's Rosario Dawson. And it's like, this does feel like a world apart. It feels like it's its own thing. And who knows, maybe down the road there will be some crossover at some level. But it does. This does not feel like we're just waiting for the other Marvel shoe to drop.
Yeah, agreed. I'm not thinking like, when is Wolverine going to show up? You know what
I mean? Exactly, yeah.
The other thing that I think is sort of interesting is, right, that you can't – you don't really know where this is, and you definitely don't really know when this is. Right?
Like, I was wondering about that because it's
60s mod, you know, thing about
right,
it.
Because the look is part of it too, right? Yeah. They definitely have that. And I assume, I didn't read the comic, but I assume that the comic has that mod look to it. Because that was very noticeable in the pilot.
Yeah, but you'll notice like a lot of the technology and stuff is very not 60s.
Exactly.
Right?
So that, and that's another thing that I think takes it apart from the Marvel universe is the rest of the Marvel universe took great pains to like make sure you know this is Marvel for today's world.
Yeah.
And this is it's like out of place, it's out of time, it's just it's the story and the dialogue and the character standing on their own, and I really like that.
Yeah. And I don't know where they found that mental hospital, but like what a cool looking place that thing was.
Seriously.
All right. Yeah, I'm ready for more Legion. I'm all about it. So
absolutely. It's less interesting than our Grammys discussion because we're both just very high on it right now. But I do think this is like one to watch. This is one to tell your friends about. This is this should be at the top of your new TV list.
Yeah, and if you're like me and definitely very unsure of the Young Pope, you're kind of on that train as well, right? You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, I mean, I think I still intend to watch it, but I have fallen behind because this is how I make most of my TV decisions, because between this show and my own horrible personal taste, there's so much piling up that ultimately it just comes down to when I look at my DVR or hard drive or Netflix account or whatever, and I survey all these things, it's just whatever of the five things I need to get to, I feel like watching at any given time. And a show like Young Pope, not unlike what happened to Walking Dead this season for me, it just keeps getting bumped down the list because there's things I'd rather watch, whether it's Sneaky Pete or Legion or whatever. These are the things that grab my attention away from other shows.
Yeah, but I do feel like there's a hole for that show. You can tell your friends, oh, you got to see this. And I think Legion's filling that nicely.
I agree. I think Young Pope was like it was the big Sunday night HBO drama that really they haven't missed with one of those in a while.
Yeah.
So I think people kind of blocked that out of their TV schedule. And I agree. I would encourage you to use that block for Legion instead if you can.
Yeah. And look, there are some people who are like insanely devoted to Young Pope.
A lot of people. And I think for mostly as I've heard it discussed and read about it, it's for visual reasons. And I get that. But I just think Legion looks just as good and is a more interesting story.
Yeah, and I would be down for that if it was the music video length. But it's an hour long show.
It's very long for a music video.
That makes no sense that I'm just looking at and like, you know. I mean,
but Kangaroo.
I like Jude Law, but like I don't. Me Jude too. Law preening for an hour like is.
It's a little much.
I need more than that for the price of admission. Thanks.
Yeah.
So Girls came back this week. Maybe that was a show for people that was kind of blocked out as, you know, HBO Sunday night. Goodness,
I hope so.
Once upon a time. For me, I've never wavered on Girls. I've been on the Girls train 100%. I saw the ratings, and this is also not a new phenomenon for them. In fact, the ratings for the premiere were, you know, up from where they were last year. But like only 500,000 people watched that first episode of Girls. It's crazy.
It is crazy. I do.
You know, I think it's like a week of Undisputed with Skip and Shannon number.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tough because it's – I don't know how to put this because I love it. And I think I truly think Lena Dunham is a genius.
Yeah. People who don't like Lena Dunham, like 90% of the time it comes down to they resent having to watch her naked.
I think it's a combination of resenting having to watch her naked, which of course you had to do an awful lot in this, this first episode. But I don't know why. This brings up an interesting question. What is your reaction to naked Lena Dunham?
At this point, I feel like, honestly, I feel like I'm used to it. What I mean? It's a little bit like when I see it now, it doesn't shock me. It's a little bit more like, gosh, she's really going for it in this episode. You know what I mean?
Right. But that's not really what I meant. I agree with that in general, but I'm thinking more like in specific, I found that most of the time that she was naked in this episode, and in fact, in the scene where Jemima Kirk was naked as well, it's funny. And it's not because Lena Dunham's naked body is funny. It's because she's doing funny things. She's using her nudity in funny ways.
I agree.
And she's like – I am convinced that Lena Dunham it at home with Jack Antonoff – looks better naked than she does on the show. I think she deliberately tries to make herself look worse naked by doing weird things and like getting herself into weird physical and emotional situations. And it's excessive in a way because she's constantly naked on the show and it doesn't always feel like there's a great reason for it. But also
– But that's also, kind of part of the joke, right?
Exactly. You know what I mean? Like, and I laugh at the joke. So like to me, a lot of the opposition to Lena Dunham naked, like whatever. Who cares if she's your favorite person to see naked or not? Like I think it's mostly people being prudish.
I agree.
Because she's not doing nudity in like an attempt to, you know – force her sexuality on you. She's making jokes, and they're good jokes.
Yeah, she's using nudity in the same way that Larry David would if he was ever naked.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
That's a great point. Yeah. It's awkward and silly and funny, and I think it's one of the things she does really well. So, like, I was laughing so much during that premiere episode, and like I found myself thinking about that like people are perturbed by Lena Dunham's nudity and. It's like I just don't think they get the joke because they're too blocked up with like a prudish notion of what's appropriate.
Yeah, and the other thing, you know, about the nudity of her and Jemima Kirk is that it's completely true to their character. You know what I mean? Like
absolutely.
You know,
that whole scene with her and Adam just like being uncomfortably sexual while Ray tries to get place to lie down. It's hilarious.
Yeah, tries to play. And why does he try to find a place to lie down? We had to move your stuff for sex reasons.
Yeah, exactly. And it was a long episode too. It was like a 40-minute episode of Girls, and I just thought. And you're right. I never wavered either, so I may not be the best test case. But I almost feel like even if you did waver over the past couple years, come back in because this was just a great episode, and I think this last season is going to be a lot of fun.
Well, and I think it's interesting, obviously a big part of the show is that these people are sort of – it can be horrible at times. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like most people, they have the capacity to be really horrible.
Absolutely.
And self-involved in whatever. But – this also, to me, at least there are signs of this being a season where not that these qualities in them are corrected in some way, but that they're more comfortable in their own skin. And they are getting older and experiencing some successes in life. And, I think that growth, in this year is obviously the show's trying to build to some sort of coda. I think it's going to be really interesting.
And it's funny you say that because I was having a probably unnecessarily deep conversation on a Valentine's Day date about yesterday about the idea of like what it is to become an adult, what growing up is, and that like I think in a lot of ways in my eyes, becoming more of an adult. Is you don't get rid of your childish problems and concerns and anxieties, but you learn to manage and you learn what is reasonable adult behavior and what is not. And Hannah is I am certain that the character Hannah will still have plenty of problems by the time this season comes to an end. But I do think that when it gets to its end point, if we compare her to the Hannah that we met in season one, we're going to find that she's learned how to live as Hannah and also as an adult a little bit more. And I think that that's, you know, that's probably the progression of the show.
And that's like the progression of life. You know
exactly.
What I mean?
That's what we all go through. Yeah. And I think anyone who pretends that they figured things out in a more meaningful way than just managing them is either lying or just not that interesting.
Yeah. I mean, no matter what happens, we're still going to be two idiots talking about movies and television in rooms slightly larger than a closet. That's just
You must be in a bigger room than me.
I said slightly.
I've never seen a closet smaller than the room that I'm in. I mean, there are some that are bigger.
You live in the Bay Area. I doubt that. I bet you've seen some small ass closets. I know I have.
Man, I lived in a closet for 3 months in London in 2004, and this room is smaller than the closet that I lived in.
All right, fair enough. All right, so I know we got to get running soon, so maybe we should jump over to the NBA.
Yeah. You thought Legion and Girls were entertaining television. Just wait till you get a load of this stuff.
So was it just me, or was Durant or Westbrook, you know, one of those rare hyped, you know, and I guess it's becoming less rare, but one of those rare hyped sporting events that turned out to be even more than maybe the hype that we were talking about coming into this thing?
Oh, I thought it was exactly what I expected.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, here's what I thought. I thought there'd be a lot of booing and all of that stuff, although I do think maybe the OKC fans were a little over the top in a way that kind of made me uncomfortable. You know what I mean?
The one thing from the fans that really made me uncomfortable was the coward stuff.
Yeah.
The cupcake thing is like whatever. But you know, Rod Brooks, who I do sports radio with every day here in San Francisco, made a really good point on this, which is that – and this speaks to so much about that city, that franchise, and obviously Russell Westbrook. The fans and shamefully the management of the Oklahoma City Thunder are taking their cues from an irrational 27-year-old.
Yeah, agreed.
And the fact that they're screaming coward at an adult man for making a life decision that has no real world impact on them is a little bit uncomfortable and inappropriate to me. But much more so, the fact that the Oklahoma City Thunder did nothing to honor or pay tribute to a man who gave them 9 years of his life and is the greatest player in the history of their franchise. No video, no message on the scoreboard, nothing to represent and say thank you, or even just to say we remember. That is shameful. And Sam Presti, the front office of the Oklahoma City Thunder, the fact that they – and there's no doubt that this is the issue – the fact that they were too scared of Russell Westbrook to honor a man – who is significantly more important to that franchise than Russell Westbrook, they should be embarrassed.
Well, I mean, look, they go hand in hand. I don't want to get into significantly more important, but certainly deserving of at least a measure of, hey, you know, thanks for what you did in this community and for this team. Because it's bigger than the team, really. And I get it. I'm not saying like shame on you, Oklahoma City fans. You shouldn't be mad. You shouldn't boo. Like if that's how you feel. No. That's how you feel.
But here's what you do: you do the video, you give them a round of applause, and then you boo him during the game. Fine. But to totally ignore his contributions, it's shameful.
And I, you know, the thing that I didn't expect, like the boos and the atmosphere, I expected.
Yes.
The physical altercations.
Yeah.
That,
it got
that
spicy.
That surprised me.
Again, it's, you know, I go right back to Rod's thing is everyone's taking their cues from Russell Westbrook. And so, you know, it didn't surprise me a ton. And I will say everything about every interaction between those two teams from pregame question answers to post-game cupcake shirts is a perfect illustration of what those two teams and two individuals are about and why one of them is going to win an NBA title this year and the other one might make the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly a continuation of all of the narratives. You know what
exactly.
I mean? Like Russ is having a singular individual season on a team that is not that good and lost the game to a team that's playing team basketball and like to be around each other. You know what I mean?
Yep, and I would just add to the team basketball versus individual thing that while clearly Russell Westbrook's team does not have the talent to compete with the Warriors under any circumstances, and that's not his fault entirely, it's his fault partially. Partially because he was playing this way when he had Kevin Durant on his team, and that's a huge reason why Kevin Durant left. And partially because even in that game, here's the thing that I think epitomizes the whole debate, rivalry, whatever you want to call it to me. Russell Westbrook down the stretch was going berserk. Madman drives to the lane. He had a couple of really impressive finishes at the rim, including just a monster dunk where he drove right through the defense and slammed not on but next to a lazy Patrick McCaw. And he did all that and fought like crazy to get his team within 12.
Right.
But he also kicked the ball around. He also turned it over constantly in situations that are not like – you know, tough break turnovers, but where he's just kicking it out of bounds because he's playing completely out of control. And then when they got within 12, Kevin Durant got the ball 30 feet from the basket, calmly looked Russell Westbrook directly in his face, and drained a three-pointer in his eye. Yeah. Quiet murder.
Yeah.
And that is the difference. Russell Westbrook will scream and yell and flail and be totally out of control and have incredible individual statistics, and Kevin Durant will quietly beat the stuffing out of you.
Yeah.
And I will take Kevin Durant every single time.
I got to give a shout out. In fact, if you have not heard this, I'm going to make it homework. Shout out to Bill Simmons.
Oh, my God. It might be the best podcast I've ever heard.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously this guy's been doing podcasts now for a very long time. I think the thing he does best in the world right now, him. And this may have been his best one. He managed to get Kevin Durant at 1 o'clock in the morning in Tosca Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really the perfect setting to just have a real conversation. And
Durant used the term real dude to describe like five different people during that podcast.
Yeah.
And that is what he was on that podcast. And it was so cool to hear a guy that's been so private and guarded over the course of his career just be a real dude for an hour. It was awesome to listen to.
It really was. You really felt like you learned a lot about the guy and his perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And to hear that, you know,
he's thoughtful, man.
Yeah, it's very thoughtful. I thought I didn't agree with everything, but
nope.
It was interesting to hear him think about it. It was interesting to hear the way that he understands the game, the passion that he has for the game. I think was really evident. Like the way this
for the
guy,
game of basketball, he's watching everybody.
Yeah, like the way this guy talks about young players on other teams,
mm-hmm.
and like just the delight in his voice when he's talking about basketball. You can also tell he's a guy who's been tired of being asked about other things that you know what I mean.
Like he's ready to talk some hoops, no question.
Yeah. But like it was just, it's a delightful peek into the man, and it was really great to have that coming in, and it really colored sort of my perspective of the game and how he was going to handle it.
Totally agree.
And I really liked it, and so I would say definitely if you've not heard that podcast and you care at all about basketball, listen to it. It was an eye opener. I think for Bill as well. You know what I mean?
Yes,
so,
I agree.
Like definitely check that out. That was one of the best things I heard last week. And there's also a Steve Kerr podcast, which is very good too. It's not quite as illuminating as the Durant, but
right. You already know Steve Kerr a lot better than you knew Kevin Durant, I think. And Durant, it's absolutely the most forthcoming. And you could tell, like, I think it was kind of set up with his appearance on Any Given Wednesday, because in that appearance, I thought he loosened up considerably over the course of the discussion as he realized that Bill Simmons loves basketball and mostly wanted to talk basketball with them. And so I think that is probably what allowed them to set this new one up and what led to Kevin Durant sort of right from the jump being so open and engaged on the recording.
Yeah, and they still hit all the things, all the non or yep. tangentially basketball things you'd want them to hit. They get them all in there. So, yeah, definitely check that out. All right. Do we have time to talk more basketball? We got to get going here, right?
Yeah. Let's sneak the Knicks in because we can't not talk about this. I'm just going to give you quickly my list of the three most horrifying people involved in this situation in order of level of horrifyingness.
Okay.
Number three is Latrell Sprewell because he's despicable and a jerk and also was screaming obscenities at James Dolan the last time he saw him before clearly getting paid in some way to sit courtside to pretend like everything was okay after Dolan disrespected Charles Oakley.
Can I go the other way on that?
No, let me finish number two is James Dolan because he's run a pretty decent basketball franchise into the ground and is an obnoxious rich kid who thinks he hit a triple after being born on third base. Okay. And number one is Larry Johnson because to be a teammate of Charles Oakley and to know the man and to sell yourself out for a garbage owner who absolutely does not care about you and is using you for PR reasons, that disgusted me. I couldn't believe that Larry Johnson would do that.
Okay. I'm going to go number one most disgusting in the situation is Michael Kay.
okay, fair enough.
Because mostly because
he had Dolan
K,
on the radio.
But also, yeah, because he signed on for this Pravda propaganda Knicks presentation and like wholeheartedly went along with it. Number two is James Dolan. I think that, like, yes, is James Dolan like a bad owner? Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Was what James Dolan did in terms of possibly implying Charles Oakley had an alcohol problem with any real knowledge of it?
He didn't imply. He said it.
Yeah, you're right. Not even. Well, yeah, you're right. He's just he didn't say he had one. He said he may have one. So that is implying. But still, that was gross.
Gross.
I do think that James Dolan is like as an owner, loyalty is he's super duper loyal, man. And you know,
well,
like
he's been loyal to two people. One of them is arguably the worst general manager in the history of the yeah. National Basketball Association, who also presided over rampant sexual harassment while he was on the job. And the other one is a guy in his mid-70s who was pretty checked out when he got hired. So yeah. I would say he's shown poor judgment as it regards loyalty because I would be loyal to Charles Oakley before I'd be loyal to either of those other dudes.
Sprewell, I'm going to give a pass to, and I'll tell you freely. I stole this point from someone who I'm forgetting, and I don't know if it was on The Jump or on a podcast or something, but it was a former player.
Okay. He's dead broke?
Who was like, I don't know, he might be dead broke. Yeah, I think that's a real possibility. But no, his point was like, Sprewell is a guy who doesn't really have an NBA home. Like all of the places he played, he left badly, right? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like things end.
So you're
poorly.
Saying and because he burned bridges, he should rebuild a bridge to like I don't know.
Here's what I'm saying is yeah, like the one place that he has the respect of the fans still is New York.
Does he now?
And, so I think that
– You don't think he lost fan respect with that
he
move?
He might have a little bit, yeah. But yeah. Not in a permanent way in the way that, like, James Dolan has. I don't think people are going to be like, well, I'm never talking to Spree again.
No,
I think Larry Johnson's probably going to be safe from that too.
But I don't think sitting with James Dolan was a positive move for fan respect.
No,
that's
but
for sure.
Here's what, but you know what I mean? Like he was a guy who obviously because of the way things ended with Dolan was completely on the outs with the team in the way that Oakley was. Like you know what I mean? Like you don't get tickets. You're not a part of the stuff. You're not invited to the things.
And all the more reason.
This is he saw
that
it as
when
a way
they
back
reach
in,
out to
in like
you,
the one place where he could actually be welcomed by the fans. You know what I mean? Like I don't know that I blame that guy so much.
Except, like, think about what you're saying. Think about what you're saying. He's suffered through what Oakley is going through right now. He knows James Dolan is a prick who is being inappropriate, barring Oakley from the garden, not to mention suggesting he has a drinking problem for no reason. It's hideous. And then to use – it's like it's Peter Pettigrew-ish, for lack of a better term. It's like nobody likes me, but oh wait – now they're more focused on not liking this other guy so I can slide in.
Yeah, but look, in the end, Oakley's going to get his, right? The, you know, the league has kind of already stepped in. The ban has already been lifted. And in end, Dolan is going to get his because no free agent around the league is going to sign up for this mess. Like, they're
That's certainly
when you
true.
Look at the way that, the, you know, that the, at least from the player's view, that Carmelo's been treated by the organization. Mm-hmm. And then you look at the way, like, everyone respects Charles Oakley. You know, players respect Charles Oakley. So, like no one's getting involved in that mess. And it's going to set the franchise back for a long time. And that's that. So, you know, karma's kind of served in this whole thing.
That's probably true, but it's still a shame. And it's just like, you know, Charles Oakley, I just hated that. Like, as much as I loved the visual insanity of watching him carry six security guards around, he's a 53-year-old man, and he has personal dignity, and he should not have had to deal with that.
Yeah, I really enjoy Oak as a 53-year-old man in a suit,
though. Oh my god, you know he's what I mean? So awesome. No one's ever been scarier with, like, gray hair
in a suit. It's so great. Yeah. You know what is really amazing to me? That, like, Derrick Rose going AWOL. Like, seem like, well, this is going to be the craziest thing that happens to the Knicks this year. And I think that was like a month ago, and it seems like a million years ago, doesn't it?
It also seems like nothing drama.
Yeah, like, it's crazy. Like, I just flat out didn't show up for a game. Just what a bizarre season. And
yeah, well, and what's crazy is, like, the Knicks, there's this picture of the Knicks as a great franchise, but the fact of the matter is they have, like, two championships in the last 60 years or whatever it is. They have a couple of other good seasons, but mostly they've been wallowing in mediocrity for their existence.
Well,
and
they have these periods, right? Like, if you came along and you saw the Walt Frazier, Bill Bradley Knicks, like, you still have a reverence for them. And you know, they didn't win a title in my basketball youth, but they, you know, they were consistently good in these Ewing, you know, Riley Van Gundy era. So, you know, people who came along in basketball in that era still sort of think of them as something. But,
right, but
the rest
it,
of it's
really.
Been junk. Yeah, it's been junk. So and it probably will continue to be for a long time. You know, and
the moves they made this summer were so weird and unhelpful. And really, this all goes back to me, it's all pretty simple. That when they re-signed Carmelo Anthony instead of simply letting him walk, they ruined the future of the franchise.
So this Porzingis thing, like, goes bad, right? Yes or no?
Well, I hope not, because I like him. But I'll tell you what, I think if you asked 15 basketball people right now who the best young European big prospect in the NBA is, I think 10 of them would say Nikola Jokic.
Interesting. You've seen Porzingis in person, right?
Like, I have not, actually.
Oh, you got to.
I know. I hope to and intend to. I love him. I've watched him plenty on TV. I think he's going to be very good. I'm just saying, part of it is the situation he's in, and part of it is that Jokic has been put in the starting lineup and getting more minutes, and he's doing incredible things. But, like, the even the pie in the sky projections for Porzingis have fallen off over the last year, maybe because he hasn't progressed as much as people would like. But I think a lot of that is where he's at.
Yeah, it's opportunity and whatnot. And look, I'm a little colored because the time that I saw him in person, he played against Karl Anthony Towns, and both of them, you know, may have had their best games of the year and were kind of going at each other, and it was incredible to watch. But, like, even outside of – I'm not even necessarily talking about, oh, I saw him score 27 points and block six shots and grab 10. You know, it's not that so much. It's just, like,
you the way just he moves on the floor.
Yeah, just run down the court, and he might not even have the ball. You know what I mean? Yep. Like, he's the 7-foot guy moving so gracefully and can do everything. It's, in the same way that, like, when you just, like, if you took someone who'd never been to a basketball game and had never heard of the NBA and sat them down in, you know, they're going to look at Porzingis and go, who was that guy? In the same way they would with the Greek Freak. And as good as, you know, Jokic is playing Durant right now, I don't know if you get that from Jokic.
You might need to know the game a little more, but that doesn't mean Jokic won't be a better player.
Yeah. I'm not, that's no knock. You know what I mean?
No, I know.
Jokic is in the witness protection program. That's the Jokic issue, right?
What was that?
He's in the witness protection program. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, he's in Denver. But also I gotta say, it's hard for me to say what someone who'd never heard of basketball before would say, but Jokic does very impressive things, and I'm not sure it would take much more than a half of basketball watching to realize how impressive the things he does are relative to his size and whatnot.
Look, I know he's good and I know the numbers, but I'm honestly trying to think. I don't know that I've really seen him play. You know,
I would say next time the T-Wolves host Denver, go take a look because he is really pretty good.
I think
good.
They were just here, too. The Nuggets aren't on TV much.
Nope.
Actually, you know what? I take that back. I think they're playing tonight.
Hey, look, there's still time. Get your tickets now.
So I don't know. I might have homework. all right. I think we should probably wrap it up on that note, right?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. So homework for the week. You got anything else besides listen to the Bill Simmons, Kevin Durant podcast?
Definitely do that. I am for sure going to see John Wick 2 this week. So hopefully we can find a way to talk a little bit of John Wick next week. But I'm telling you, just go rent one and see how it impacts you.
You know, I torrented one. And
oh, you did? Okay.
I did. You know, I have a lot of movie goals. I really got to start. I have Oscar work to do before the show. So that's going to be my focus before I get to John Wick. But I promise I will get to John Wick and maybe John Wick 2 at some point.
And if you watch Oscar movies, we'll talk about those because that thing's coming up.
Yeah, it is coming up. And I got to see La La Land. I think I need to see Lion, although I feel like that's a little bit of a waste of time because, come on, it's not going to win anything, right?
It's not, but it was good.
And I really want to see Hell or High Water because I've just heard so
Me
much
too.
About it.
Let's make that homework. Let's make Hell or High Water homework because I want to see that too. Let's find out about this Jeff Bridges thing.
All right. So so there you go. That's homework. It'll be plenty. I'm traveling this week. So sometimes that helps me watch stuff and sometimes it doesn't.
There
you know
what
I mean?
Plane movies.
You know, now that you can download Netflix though, man.
Oh, that's great. Oh,
it's so great. All right. Thank you guys for listening and we will talk to you again next week.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling. And the jello is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.